Wiem, czym się Sabbath. Since I'm actually going to talk a lot about Isaiah 58, so I wish I said Unek Shabbat, a delightful Sabbath. As Shepherd said, it is a handout, it should be somewhere. So if you don't have a handout, just try to find it somewhere in the room. I've changed the title slightly, so it reads Prophets Interpreting the Law. Guides for those living in the typological fulfillment, the day of provision. The nature of Scripture includes cases of interbiblical legal reuse, and they function as instructive resources for those living in the typological fulfillment of the day of provision, often rendered as the Day of Atonement. The thesis of my presentation is that the prophets speaking in critical periods to the people of God and applying the biblical law with an inspired vision are a divinely ordained guide for us to understand how the law should be applied in a contemporary context. This paper is divided into two major sections. The first section is a discussion of the concepts we use when studying reuse of former biblical passages by later biblical authors. I will here outline a method to study these. The second section will be a concrete case study to illustrate how reuse can be studied according to this method. I've chosen Isaiah 58. Why precisely Isaiah 58? Because its reuse of passages and themes from the Day of Purgation, Year of Jubilee, and Weekly Sabbath seem to carry particular significance for us claiming to live in the typological fulfillment of the Day of Perdition. I do not believe that Isaiah 58 is a randomly selected chapter for us today. And White wrote, I cannot too strongly urge all our church members, all who are true missionaries, all who believe the third angel's message, all who turn away their feet from the Sabbath, to consider the message of the 58th chapter of Isaiah. The work of beneficence enjoined in this chapter is the work that God requires his people to do at this time. It is a work of his own appointment. God's people have a special work to do in repairing the breaches that have been made in his law. And the nearer we approach the end, the more urgent this work becomes. All who love God will show that they bear his sign by keeping his commandments. They are the resource of paths to dwelling. The genuine medical missionary work is bound up inseparably with keeping God's commandments, of which the Sabbath is especially mentioned, since it is the great memorial of God's creative work. Its observance is bound up with the work of restoring the moral image of God and man. This is the ministry which God's people are to care forward at this time. This ministry, rightly performed, will bring rich blessings to the church. End quote. The focus of this paper is therefore upon the reuse of biblical law in the prophetic corpus, and more specifically, the reuse of Leviticus 16, 23, and 25 in Isaiah 58. The question of category. Before entering Isaiah 58, I will, as mentioned, first look at a question of how we can study interbiblical reuse in a sound manner. While scholars for a long time have been aware of the prophets' use of other biblical material in their oracles, the complexities of the question still haunt the field. Schultz's comment on reuse within the prophetic corpus is also applicable to parallel passages between the law and the prophets. Parallel passages represent an important component, a prophetic rhetoric, which must be reckoned with in any attempt to assess the nature, the prophetic task, and the relationship between distinct prophetic writings. However, despite the considerable scholarly effort already devoted to the study of such passages, little progress has been made. little or no consensus has emerged regarding what distinguishes a quotation from a mere verbal coincidence or vague reminiscence, or which criteria are most useful for correctly identifying, explaining the origin of, and assessing the significance of literary borrowing. He also gives the sobering comment that the disagreement over methodology of prophetic quotations reflects not so much the subjectivity of scholarly approaches as the complexity of the phenomenon of the quotation. Any hopes of a simplistic solution to the problem of prophetic quotation should be dispelled immediately. Methodological issues surrounding the study of interbiblical reuse have been given attention by some in recent years. Fishbein's groundbreaking work, Biblical Interpretation in Ancient Israel, stirred a scholarly debate concerning interbiblical exegesis within the Hebrew Bible. What are the categories we can use when analyzing parallel passages in Scripture? Space does not allow us here to discuss all the major concepts used by theologians to categorize interbiblical reuse. I have therefore chosen to focus especially upon intertextuality, allusion, echo, exegesis, and application. Intertextuality. The term intertextuality is primarily associated with the post-structuralist work of Julia Kristeva, who joined the term. For her, and here's a typo, for her, texts are understood to be part of a larger set of signifying systems, and only in such systems can they come into being or be understood. The literary signs are seen as meaningful only insofar as they stand in relation and opposition to other signs. Following Bakhtin, Kristeva writes, any text is construed as a mosaic of quotations. Any text is the absorption and transformation of another. The notion of intertextuality replaces that of intersubjectivity. Robin Barthes puts it as follows. Intertextuality, the condition of any text whatsoever, cannot, of course, be reduced to a problem of sources and influences. The intertext is a general field of anonymous formula whose origin can scarcely ever be located, of unconscious or automatic quotations given without quotation marks. End quote. Intertextual approaches to the biblical texts can thus be seen in relation to recent literary critics who view a text as a mosaic and patchwork quilt of other pretexts. It is on the basis of this view that Barthes could claim the death of the author and rather focus on readers who, by finding new textual relations, discover multiple meanings within texts and thus rewrite or reweave texts from threads of innumerable other texts. In summary, we could say that intertextuality, 1, focus on the text and reader, not the author or intention. Emphasize parallels and similarities between many texts, but not intentional use by one author of one or more concrete texts. 3, read intertextual relations synchronically, without being concerned with diachronic relations between texts. Sumer comments that the study of intertextuality ignores questions related to authorial intent and chronological relations between texts. Even if many biblical theologians have used the term intertextuality, often I think confusing it with inner biblical exegesis, I do not find it to be an appropriate term for an analysis of the intentional reuse of biblical law in the prophets. Allusion and echo. Sumer notes that the study of allusions belong more to the interpretation of relations between specific texts. Siva Ben-Peron explains that literary allusion is often misunderstood as linking unrelated texts. Rather, she says, it should be understood as linking related texts, where the alluding text from a form
a continuation of the referent text. She roughly outlines four stages in the identification of literary allusion. One, recognition of a marker in a given sign. Two, identification of the evoked text. Three, modification of the initial local interpretation of the signal. And four, activation of the evoked text as a whole in an attempt to form maximum intertextual pattern. Sumer says that when only the first two of Benpurat's criteria are fulfilled, when the meaning of the marked sign in the source has little effect on a reading of the sign with the marker in the alluding text, he will define this as echo, in contrast to allusion, which fulfills all four criteria. Exegesis and application. Sumer juxtaposes exegesis and allusion, defining the former as an attempt to analyze, explain, or give meaning to, or uncover meaning in a text. An exegetical text clarifies or transforms an earlier text. An allusive text utilizes an earlier text. However, he adds that the line dividing exegesis from allusion is permeable. An individual and individual cases may straddle the distinction or challenges. Sumer speaks of the distinction between exegesis and allusion, therefore, as permeable. Often scholars treat the conceptual tools by which they analyze the text too loosely. As Schultz writes in regard to allusion, although the criteria for identifying allusions have become increasingly sophisticated, a troubling degree of subjectivity remains in employing them. Exegesis should be differentiated from another term, application. Application is found when an author, most likely based on an exegesis, also attempts to actualize the former text in his or her contemporary setting. While exegesis could be defined as cases where the meaning of a law is attempted to be drawn out and or explicated, application could be understood as an actualization of a former law in an author's attempt, in an author's contemporary literary or cultural setting. It should be pointed out that a major weakness in all the above approaches or terms is that they take categories used within modern literary critical approaches and apply them to the biblical text belonging to an entirely different and much earlier literary tradition. It is thus not a bottom-up approach. As argued above, the category of intertextuality I do not find very helpful for a study of the prophet's use of biblical law. Allusion, echo, exegesis, and application do seem to have a certain value in this type of studies, but care should constantly be exercised so that the textual phenomena is allowed to speak within its own textual tradition, so we do not impose foreign categories upon it and lump various textual phenomena together that are really different, simply because our tools are not refined enough. Even though our criteria and procedures should strive for as strong objective textual support as possible, it is still an illusion to believe that we can exclude the subjective element in our analytical reading. It is also a question if this is really a goal. While acknowledging our subjectivity within the study of biblical parallels, we still need to sharpen our tools as much as possible to limit subjectively imposed and textually unwarranted readings of the text. Criteria for determining inner biblical reuse. Instead of using categories which we try to fit the textual phenomena into, I've come to appreciate more a descriptive terminology. I here find William Tooman's terminology and criteria to be helpful and attractive. The advantage of Tooman's methodology is that it allows a more bottom-up approach. In general, he speaks of scriptural reuse. While being neutral in regard to categories from literary criticism, it still implies intentional repetition of an older text, thus focusing on the diachronic relation between texts and directionality of dependence. It neither presupposes our compositional history, except in establishing a chronological relation between the two texts. We can speak of reuse in cases where we find sufficient textual evidence to say that one text or set of texts in all likelihood reuse another text or set of texts. Tooman suggests five criteria for identifying scriptural reuse. One, uniqueness. According to the criteria of uniqueness, the element needs to be unique to a particular source other than the one reusing it. Two, distinctiveness. The criterion of distinctiveness claims that even if an element might not be exclusive to a particular text, at least it should be demonstrable that it is specifically associated with a particular antecedent text. Three, multiplicity. A strong indication of reuse is the multiplicity of several elements from the evoked text. It should be underlined here that multiplicity is not determined by arbitrary statistical criteria. The accumulation of reused elements strengthens relatively the case for claiming a case of reuse. For thematic correspondence. The criteria of thematic correspondence focus on how authors draw from previous texts, sharing similar subjects, themes, or arguments with the text they are composing. Five, inversion. Finally, we can see a clear marker of reuse in the inversion, conflation, and recombination of similar elements in the evoked text by the borrowing text. It should here be noted that claims concerning reuse will always follow a relative scale, spanning from weak to strong textual support. The strength and weight of each individual textual support for such claims will be perceived differently by various scholars. Nevertheless, the more of the criteria that are fulfilled, the stronger the argument will be. Isaiah 58 as a case study. Having clarified how parallel passages and reuse within the Bible can be studied, I now want to turn to a concrete example to illustrate this in a given case. Julius Wellhausen famously argued in his Prolegomena that the prophets preceded the law. He writes, "The prophets have notoriously no father. They do not preach on set texts. They speak out of the Spirit, which judges all things and itself is judged of no man. Where do they ever lean on any other authority than the truth of what they say? Where do they rest on any other foundation than their own certainty?" This idea has dominated scholarship ever since. The issue of the direction of dependence between the law and the prophets cannot simply be assumed. Still, in this congregation, I take a certain freedom. Since I assume that most of us here will agree on the direction of dependence between the law and the prophets, I don't want to spend much time on this and simply skip that point here, even though it would have to be argued in other contexts. Instead, I want to focus primarily upon how Isaiah 58 reuses passages from Leviticus 16, 23, and 25. I cannot here spell out all the ways these passages are applied by Isaiah to his own time. But as we study the cases of reuse, I believe some of it will become clear. A key concept for establishing a case of reuse between Isaiah 58 and Leviticus 16 and 23 is in the phrase anna in PL plus nefesh. We only find these lexemes used together in Leviticus 16, 29, 31, Leviticus 23, 27, and 32, Numbers 29, 7, 30, 14, Psalms 35, 13, Isaiah 58, 3, 5, and 10. All these passages refer to the day of purgation, except in the cases of Numbers 30, verse 14, and Psalms 35, 13. Outside the Torah, only Psalms 35, 13 and Isaiah 58 use this expression. In Numbers 30, verse 14, the legislation concerns self-imposed vows and sworn obligations of self-denial of a woman dependent upon her father or husband. Here the phrase does not seem to be limited only to fasting, and might refer to other forms of self-denial, as sexual abstinence. Psalm 35:13 appears to be more limited to mere fasting, as it also includes the word tzom, fast. The psalmist prays by afflicting himself through fasting, as for a friend or a brother, as he says, for those maligning him and repaying his goodness with evil. The phrase ana nefesh seems in itself to refer to a general sense of self-denial as an outward expression accompanying supplication to God at a time of inner distress. Psalms 35:13 seems too far removed from Isaiah 58 to argue that there is reuse between the two. Still, Isaiah 58 uses the phrase ana nefesh and tzom, like Psalm 35:13. On the other side, tzom is absent from the Torah, including Leviticus 16 and 23 specifically. The following question therefore arises: is Isaiah 58's more narrow understanding of self-denial, ana nefesh, as fasting tzom, simply using a common understanding of self-denial as fasting from the time of its composition? Or can it be argued that Isaiah 58 nevertheless is reusing the concept of ana nefesh from the day of purgation in Leviticus 16, 23, having a more broader understanding of ana nefesh? The phrase ana nefesh could be said to be distinctive to the day of purgation, but it is not unique to. Based on the above evidence, I would therefore argue that the phrase ana nefesh is not conclusive in itself to say that there is a reuse between Leviticus 16 and 23 and Isaiah 58. We need corroborating evidence to make this claim. A second indicator that Isaiah reuses Leviticus 16 and 23 is in the manner he alters the phrase ana nefesh and gives it a new meaning in his own text. The root ana is used in Isaiah 58, 3, 5, 9, and 10. Nefesh in Isaiah 58, 3, 5, 10, and 11. And the entire phrase, ana nefesh, appears in Isaiah 58, 3, 5, and 10. In verse 3 and 5, ana nefesh seems to be used largely as we find it in Leviticus 16 and 23, namely for affliction in the form of fasting or self-affliction. As we come to verses 9 to 11, their meanings are altered. The form ana in Hebrew has namely two different roots, ana 2 meaning to afflict, and ana 1 meaning to answer. In verses 3 and 5, ana 2 as affliction is used. In verse 9, ana is no longer ana 2, but Isaiah has changed it to ana 1 to answer. Now it is used in a promise that God will respond if the people take care of the afflicted and hungry. In verse 3, the people complained over the silence of God, that he did not respond to their religious practice. In verse 9, God promises that he will again answer his people if they correct their social practice. Further, in verse 10, ana nefesh no longer signifies self-affliction. It is now used for the person being afflicted, not the one afflicting himself, but the one that has been afflicted, indicated by the use of the niphal. The noun nefesh plus participle of ana, construction is the representation of an action as ongoing at a reference time. This is not simply a temporary situation, as in the case of the day of purgation, where it just took place on one day. It is a call to satisfy the need of a person being in a more permanent and desperate state. In verse 10, nefesh is again used in the clause, and he will satisfy your person in desert land. Now again as a part of a promise. God promises to satisfy the person, the nefesh, who has taken care of the afflicted, ana, and hungry. The alteration of nefesh, ana nefesh, in the second half of Isaiah 58, therefore seems to be strategic when compared to Leviticus 16 and 23, and supports the claim that Isaiah 58 reuses and is dependent upon Leviticus 16, 23, and 25. Here, I'll just take a little break also, because reading through and preparing, I realized that in my preparation and attempt to cut or make the paper as short as possible, I'd left out a part that needs to be part of it, so I'll just take it here and include it at this point. Because, you see, I've been referring to Leviticus 25, the chapter on the year of jubilation, or jubilee. And I would also argue that Isaiah 58 is picking up and strategically reusing Leviticus 25. You see it in the opening word, kra, or call. And even though you could say that, well, the verb call or proclaim is not unique, you would find it all over the place. Still, you see that this is a word used also for calling to the festivals, to the religious festivals. In the same opening verse in Isaiah 58, verse 1, you have the shofar being used or alluded to. And even though you could also say that the shofar is mentioned as being used for other festivals, as the festival of New Moon, Hosea mentions that you use the shofar for calling just a general fast. Still again, sort of the verb to proclaim together with the shofar again points the reader to Leviticus 25. And when we come to verse 6 in Isaiah 58, speaking of liberation, sort of removing oppression, I think the thematic link to the year of Jubilee is very clear. So Isaiah 58, I'll come refer to that later on, but reuses Leviticus 25 to give the day of purgation and Leviticus 16 and 23 a new flavor, a new meaning, which would be difficult to see only from Leviticus 16 and 25 itself. But since the day of Jubilee was proclaimed exactly on the day of purgation, Isaiah seems to see a justified link between the two, that he can then bring in the theme from the year of Jubilee into the day of purgation also. And therefore we get this radical message in Isaiah 58. Okay, and then I'll just continue. Then we thirdly find the puzzling formulation in verse 10. And you offer your person, nefesh, to the hungry. This clause has challenged ancient as well as modern readers. It has been rendered as, one, the desired attitude toward the hungry, two, your bread, and three, providing food generously or with a good attitude. To me, it seems as if Isaiah intended to say something more than he simply did earlier in verse 7, to break your bread, lechem, for the hungry. By replacing lechem, bread, with nefesh in verse 10, in the phrase, and you offer your person, nefesh, to the hungry, he's able to integrate the message of the day of purgation with the people's relation to the hungry. The affliction, ana, of oneself nefesh, entails for him to replace oneself or to place oneself at disposal for the hungry. Again, this shows how Isaiah 58 reworks the law concerning the day of purgation, so as to expose an inherent message of social justice in it. This would also confirm that Isaiah 58 is dependent upon Leviticus and not vice versa. The fourth point is the cessation of labor. In Leviticus 16:29, we read, "And you shall not do any work." The same is restated in Leviticus 23, verse 28, 30, and 31. Isaiah never uses the word melacha. Instead of melacha plus asa, to do your work, as in Leviticus 16 and 23, we do, however, find chafetz plus asa, to do business, or delight, in Isaiah 58, verse 13. Isaiah 58:3 seems to give a basis for saying that chafetz in Isaiah 58 is not simply used as desire and delight, but more specifically for business occupation. In verse 3, the clause, "Behold, on the day of your fast you seek business," chafetz, is followed by "and oppress your laborers." Here doesn't seem to be the use of delight, but in a more business setting. It is possible that Isaiah 58 plays on the meaning, on both meanings of chafetz, as desire, delight, and as business occupation. In verse 2, it seems to be the meaning desire, delight, that is in the foreground. They seek me daily and desire, chafetz, the knowledge of my ways. They ask me for justice of righteousness. They desire, chafetz, the nearness of God. In verse 3, it is possible that Isaiah intended both meanings. If you hold back your foot on the Sabbath from doing both your delight and business on my holy day, and you honor it rather than doing your ways, rather than finding your delight, business, chafetz. If Isaiah wanted this play of meanings, it can explain why he chose to replace melacha in Leviticus 16 and 23 with chafetz. This would allow him to expose that the real desire, chafetz, of the people was not to seek God, but to do their own business, even on the day of purgation, and during the weekly Sabbath and the year of Jubilee. This also illustrates how Isaiah, as a secondary author, can take liberties in altering an evoked text to more richly convey the message he felt called to give. As God is the main speaker in Isaiah 58, we could even say that God himself here shows literary creativity in Isaiah in his confrontation of his hypocrite people. This wordplay would also support the claim that Isaiah 58 reuses and is dependent upon Leviticus 16 and 23. Just point out here also that this is not necessarily without textual basis, nevertheless, because playing on the relation between Leviticus 25, the year of Jubilee, and the day of purgation in Leviticus 16 and 23, it's also textual support for this expansion that we find in Isaiah 58. The fifth point would be the acknowledgement of sin. In Leviticus 16:21, we read, "And he, Aaron, shall confess for it the life goad, all the wickedness of the sons of Israel, and all their rebellion, and all their sins." In comparison, Isaiah 58:1 says, "And make known to my people their rebellion, and to the house of Jacob their sin." The situation is different. In Leviticus 16, the people have confessed their sin. But in Isaiah 58, they are called to a solemn assembly to be told their sin. In verse 2 and 3, the people do seem ignorant about their true spiritual situation. A New Testament parallel could here be the Laodicean church, who in Revelation 3, 15 and 17, also seems ignorant about their true situation. This ignorance has in Isaiah 58 apparently also led to a lack of previous confession of sin. So their sins need to be made known and spelled out to them. If the claim that Isaiah 58 reuses Leviticus 16 and 23, speaking of the day of purgation, is valid, this would only heighten the intensity of the opening words of Isaiah 58. Coming to the day of purgation, unrepentant, with unconfessed sins, would be detrimental for the people. The exposure of this critical situation seems intended to catch the attention of Isaiah's audience. It therefore seems reasonable to conclude that there is a reuse between Isaiah 58 and the day of purgation in Leviticus 16 and 23, and the announcement of the year of Jubilee in Leviticus 25, verse 9 and 10, based on the following parallels. 1. The use of the phrase anah nefesh, being distinct, if not unique, to the day of purgation. 2. The strategic reuse and alteration of the phrase anah nefesh in Isaiah 58. 3. The inclusion of the odd formulation, and you offer your person, nefesh, to the hungry, in verse 10, to integrate the relation to the hungry with the law concerning the day of purgation. 4. The idea of the cessation of labor and replacement of the melacha in order to facilitate a play on the double meaning of hefetz. And 5. The thematic correspondence of the people having confessed their sin on the day of purgation, but live in unrepentant ignorance of it in Isaiah 58:6. I therefore find the accumulation of several parallels between Isaiah 58 and Leviticus 16, 23 and 25 to also satisfy the criterion of multiplicity. Summary. Isaiah 58 exposes what it means to live in the day of purgation. By reading it in light of the year of Jubilee in Leviticus 25, the prophet Isaiah, or even God himself, reuses Leviticus 16:23 to awaken the people to the critical situation they are living in. The message of Isaiah 58 would be difficult to get from Leviticus 16 and 23 itself. But by combining it with Leviticus 25 and the year of Jubilee, God exposes that the true meaning of the day of purgation is not to attend to one's own desires and business, not even simply to deny oneself. Rather, it is to tear the bread away from your own mouth, to share it with those who lack food. It is not so much to give up, to go up to the temple, synagogue or church, as to bring the homeless into your own house. It is not so much to cover yourself with sackcloth and ashes, as to cover the naked with clothes. This is the true meaning of living on the day of purgation, and it should awaken thoughts and actions among us claiming to live in the typological fulfillment of the day of purgation. At the end of this presentation, I would like to read two further quotes from Ellen White in regard to Isaiah 58, which can also serve as a summary. The first quote continues after the paragraph we read in the beginning of this presentation. As believers in Christ, we need greater faith. We need to be more fervent in prayer. Many wonder why their prayers are so lifeless, their faith so feeble and wavering, their Christian experience so dark and uncertain. Have we not fasted, they say, and walked mournfully before the Lord of hosts? In the 58th chapter of Isaiah, Christ has shown how this condition of things may be changed. He says, "Is not this the fast that I've chosen? To loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke? Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thy house? When thou seest the naked, that thou cover him, and that thou hide not thyself from thy own flesh." This is the recipe that Christ has prescribed for the faint-hearted, doubting, trembling soul. Let the sorrowful ones who walk mournfully before the Lord arise and help someone who needs help. And this sympathy and love will be followed by blessings. And she continues, if you engage in the work of mercy and love, will the work prove too hard for you? Will you fail and be crushed under the burden, and your family be deprived of your assistance and influence? Oh no. God has carefully removed all doubts upon this question by a pledge to you on condition of your obedience. This promise covers all that the most exacting, the most hesitating could crave. Then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thine health shall spring forth speedily. Only believe that he is faithful, that hath promised. God can renew the physical strength, and more, he says he will do. And the promise does not end here. Thy righteousness shall go before thee. The glory of the Lord shall be thy reward. God will build a fortification around thee. The promise does not stop even here. Then shalt thou call, and the Lord shall answer. Thou shalt cry, and he shall say, here I am. If you put down oppression and remove the speaking of vanity, if you draw out your soul to the hungry, then shall thy light rise in obscurity, and thy darkness be as the noonday, and the Lord shall guide thee continually, and satisfy thy soul in drought, and make fat thy bone. And thou shalt be like a water garden, and like a spring of water, whose waters fail not. And then she concludes, read Isaiah 58, ye who claim to be children of the light.